Rarely on time.
We can smoothly start. I'm sure people will join in the next few minutes, Rory. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Today, we have the pleasure to have Rory Smith from Korea. As usual, a bit of a biography about our speaker. Rory graduated in Cardiff. Then she got her first postdoctoral fellowship in Chile, in Concepcion, for several years, moving through Sewasacliff for a while. He got a postdoctoral position and then a research professorship in Korea. It was 2015, right? And then since 5 years, he's a staff scientist at the Korea Astronomy and Space Science Institute. Invited today by Alessandro. Rory, you're welcome. And I invite people to ask even during his presentation. Please.
Thanks, Carlo. Thanks for the introduction. So let me just share the screen. So hopefully you can all see my title slide here. So yeah, as Carlo mentioned, my name's Rory Smith, and I'm a staff scientist at KASI, which is the Korea Astronomy and Space Science Institute, which is in Daejeon in South Korea. And I'm going to be talking about tidally induced features in cluster early type dwarf galaxies. And I'm going to show some results of simulations like the figure shown on the right hand side here, and also of observations like shown on the left. So in 2006, Thorsten Liske published a paper on this very topic, and he was examining many of the cluster dwarf ellipticals in Virgo using newly available SCSS imaging. And he was basically subtracting off model galaxies modeled with ellipse from the original image in SCSS in order to have a residual map. And here you can see some examples of the residual maps. On the left, you've got the original image, and on the right, you've got the residual map. And what he found was that in many of these dwarf ellipticals, you had some really interesting features. Sometimes you saw a kind of bar-like structure. Often you saw spiral arms, and sometimes the spiral arms were quite tightly wrapped into quite impressive looking spiral features. And he actually analyzed the amount of light that was in these structures compared to the total light of the galaxy. And he found that it was typically about 5 or 10%. So there was just a small fraction in these spiral features, and it was dominated by this kind of smooth diffuse component. But actually the features are fairly common. At the bright end of the luminosity function, as many as about half of the bright dwarf ellipticals could show features like this. So as part of a collaboration with Thorsten, we decided to try and understand better where these features might be coming from using numerical simulations. So the model that we used was my harassment model from my 2015 study. And in this study, we basically model a Virgo-like mass cluster, and the tidal potential is extracted from a cosmological simulation using analytical potentials. And this is quite a kind of numerically cheap and very fast computational way of tidal field of the cluster. And it evolves with time as the cluster builds up. And you also consider all of the substructure within the cluster as well. And we previously used this model in the past to study how the effects of harassment depend on a galaxy's properties. For example, the halo mass, halo concentration, the disk size, or the stellar disk mass. More recently, we also used it to kind of comprehensively study how the effects of harassment depend on orbital parameters in my 2015 study. But in this study, we're going to really focus on stellar disk dynamics and fix some of these other parameters that we've looked at previously. So we're going to concentrate on stellar disk dynamics. We're going to fix the halo and disk mass and size. So the model has a 10 to the 11 solar mass halo and a 10 to the 9 stellar mass disk. So this is quite a luminous dwarf elliptical, but it's kind of typical of the kind of objects that were in our observational sample. and the disk size is 1.5 kiloparsecs, which is fairly typical for a galaxy of this mass. And then what we do is we vary the stellar dynamics from high to medium to low rotational support. And you can see in the panels on the bottom that as we go from high rotation through to low rotation, we're looking at the dynamical radial profiles here. And the black curves are the azimuthal velocities. So that's the rotation curve. And the colored curves are the dispersion profiles. And you can see that as we go from left to right, the rotation curve kind of decreases, the dispersion increases, and eventually in the low rotational model, the dispersion is kind of dominating at all radii. Now, when we look at observed cluster dwarf ellipticals, there's actually a range of dynamical properties in their stellar disks. But most cluster dwarf ellipticals are more like this low rotational model shown on the right. Those cases where there is actually quite strong rotation generally don't exceed that of the medium rotational model shown in the middle. And so this high rotational model that I show on the left should be considered quite extreme because rotation completely dominates at all radii. So it's a bit kind of unrealistic to have this strength of rotation compared to what we observe. However, this particular model on the left is quite important for the conclusions of the study. So this is important to keep in mind that it's extreme. So as I mentioned before, we looked at orbits in detail in a previous study with something like 169 different orbits. But here we're just going to focus on 8 orbits, and we chose 4 strong harassment orbits on the left and 4 weak harassment orbits on the right. And you'll notice that the strong harassment orbits tend to have many pericenter passages over the length of the time of the simulation. And also those pericenter passages are very small, so they may go within about 100 or 200 kiloparsecs of the cluster center. And actually, if you compare these orbits to the typical orbits in my 2015 study with the many different orbits that we considered, these orbits should be considered quite extreme. They're quite strong. They're at least 1 or 2 sigma higher, stronger in terms of the number of pericenter passages and the size of these pericenter passages as well. And we also consider these weak harassment orbits on the right, and you'll see that they have many less pericenter passages and they're much less plunging. And these are actually much more typical because they're more or less within 1 sigma of the average from my 2015 paper. So now I'm going to show you a movie of the response of the stellar disk to one of these strong harassment orbits. And actually, this is one of the high rotationally supported disk models. And you'll see that it starts off quite kind of flocculent without any clear structure in the disk. It's fairly smooth to begin with. And then every now and then something dramatic happens. And actually, when this happens, for example, now, this is when the disk has just passed pericenter passage and it's suffered tidal shocking. And you can see that this causes kind of triggering of structure in the disk. We see that bars are formed near the center, and we can often see kind of spiral features are generated in the disk. So I'm just going to show you some snapshots from that simulation now. So this is a single disk on a single orbit, in fact, all of these different morphologies. But you can see that we get a whole range of different morphologies in the disk. We have on the top left this bar and spiral arms. Then we have this much more tightly wrapped spiral arms. We can get a very strong bar with spiral arms kind of produced from the ends of the bar. We can also get these kind of overdensity regions around the bar. And these are actually the Lagrange points. Sometimes the overdensities are on either side of the bar, the L4 and L5 point. Sometimes they're at either end of the bar, the L1 and L2 point. And sometimes you can get all 4 of these simultaneously. And this is basically because the potential around the bar is not actually symmetric. And so these Lagrange points can occur. And then occasionally we also see this other structure down here in the bottom right, a ring-like structure around the bar, with these like kind of dumbbell features on either end. So there's quite a range of different morphologies produced. And here I'm going to show you the time evolution of just one of these strong orbits, strong harassment orbits. And on the right, I show you the time evolution going down the plot. And on the x-axis, we're showing the cluster-centric distance. And you can see that we start off here at time 0, and then we move down and we pass pericenter. This is the black cross. First pericenter passage. Then later we pass first apocenter, it's the next black cross. There's a second pericenter, a second apocenter, and so on. And these little red crosses that we're going past, these are actually the times of the snapshots that I show you on the left-hand side. So let's first just concentrate on the first column, which is the high rotational support model that we've been looking at so far. When we first pass pericenter, we trigger this structure, and this is the strong spiral structure that we see in the snapshot at 1.6 gigayears. Then afterwards, we pass apocenter, we get to time equals 2.3 gigayears. And here you can see that the tight spiral structure is still existing. So this is quite an interesting point, because it means that although the structure is being generated at pericenter passages, it's quite long lasting. And so it can actually survive all the way until the apocenter of the orbit. And this actually means that we don't expect this spiral structure to only be found near the cluster center. It can actually be spread throughout the cluster because the structure lasts quite a long time. And this kind of softens some of the radial gradients that you might expect to get. Now, having passed the first apocenter, we now pass the second pericenter, and that takes us to T equals 3.2 gigayears. And we, this generates an even stronger bar and these kind of spiral arms coming out the ends of the bar. And again, this structure lasts past the second apocenter to time equals 3.7 gigayears. We've still got some spiral features, and some of these like Lagrange regions start to appear around the bar. So you can see that you get this whole range of different structures, even just for a single orbit. And this is in the high rotational model. However, if we now compare the high rotational model column to the low rotational model column, you'll see that even though this model has exactly the same orbit and the same tidal history, so the same things are happening to it at the same time, there's almost no features being generated by tidal shocking in the low rotational model. It's completely smooth. And this really highlights just how important the stellar disk dynamics are for how the disk responds to tidal shocking. If we then take the case of the medium rotational support model, which is kind of the upper end of the rotational support that we might find observationally in cluster dwarfs, none of this kind of fine spiral structure forms in this model either. The best we get is a kind of thick disk-wide bar across the disk face. So we really need to have very high rotational support, higher than is actually observed, if we want to generate this kind of fine spiral structure. So this gave us an idea, because you may remember that when I was introducing the observations that Thorsten published, only about 10% of the light of the disk was actually in these spiral features, and about 90% of the light was actually in a smooth diffuse component. So this gave us the idea that maybe real cluster dwarf disks could actually be made up of two components. There could be a cold disk, just a small fraction of the disk, maybe about 10%, which is cold and highly rotationally supported, and maybe the rest of the disk, 90% or so, could be in this hot, low rotationally supported component. So to test this idea out, we built a mixture model where both components are in the disk at the same time, 10% in a cold disk, 90% in a hot disk, and we introduced this into our harassment model with one of these strong harassment orbits. And this is what we see if we now look at the two components separately. On the left, I'm showing the cold disk, and on the right, I'm showing the hot component. And you can see that once again, we can generate this kind of spiral structures and bar-like features just in the thin component, but we really don't generate much structure at all in the thick component. So this seems like a good possibility to explain the observations. So I mentioned that this talk isn't just about simulations, it's also about observations. And after Thorsten had published his STSS paper, he followed up on some of these dwarfs in Virgo with much deeper observations using the ESO 2.2 meter wide field imaging. And this was quite deep images, reaching down to about 29 magnitudes B-band per arc second squared with a white filter in order to get the maximum amount of signal. And in these deep images, you could really see some quite spectacular spiral structure, like this example that I'm showing you here. But we decided to reanalyze these images. And this was actually part of Josefina Michea's PhD thesis. And she's a PhD student at Heidelberg University. Her supervisor is Anna Pasquale. And the idea of her project was to try and better quantify the fraction of light in the diffuse component and separately the fraction of light in these kind of spiral features. And in this project, Katerina from LAM gave us some really helpful support, which I'll talk about in a second. Now, the idea of this her project was basically that whenever we want to separate the diffuse component from the spiral features, normally we subtract off this galaxy model to get a residual map. But the problem is that when you make the galaxy model, you end up with some of the light in the spiral features getting into the galaxy model accidentally. And then when you subtract the two components, you over-subtract. And the result is that you get negative pixels in the inter-arm regions. So I'm not going to go into the full details of how the method works because it's a little bit technical and complicated, but you can read all about them in Cosafina's paper, which has just been accepted to AJ. But the very basic idea is that we enter into a kind of iterative process that corrects for this over-subtraction. And we iterate around until we've got rid of these negative pixels in the inter-arm regions. And then we jump out of the iterative loop. And here is some examples of the results of this. Here are nine of our objects from our sample, which actually showed the interesting features. And on the left, you've got the original image. And on the right, you've got these residual maps that are produced by this technique. And you can already start to see some very similar features to those that we saw in the simulations. So VCC 308 up here or VCC 856 both show these really nice, fine, tightly wrapped spiral features. You can also see examples of strong bars like VCC 940 or VCC 1695 being generated. In some cases, there are bars with the spiral arms kind of ejecting from the ends of the bar. And in some cases, we see that these arms are kind of wrapped around completely into a kind of ring-like structure around the bar here and in 523 and maybe in 1010 as well. And sometimes we get these kind of overdense regions that could be perhaps these Lagrange regions that I talked about. So we seem to be getting many of the same features that we saw in the simulations from tidal shocking. So we also tried to sum up just how much light is in these non-diffuse features. So we calculated the residual light fraction, which is shown on the y-axis here. This is the amount of light in the residual map divided by the total light of the galaxy. And we measure it within one or two effective radii. And I'm plotting this against the luminosity of the galaxy. And what you see is that typically we get values of roughly between about 2% and maybe 7% of the total luminosity of the galaxy within those apertures. And we don't see a particularly clear trend with the luminosity of the galaxy. Perhaps there is one there, but with such a small sample, I think it's difficult for us to say. Now, this is where Katerina's help came in so vital for the study. And up here in the top left, I'm showing one of our residual maps, VCC 1896. And Katerina allowed us to try and break down one of these residual maps into the Fourier modes, the separate Fourier components. So here you can see a map of mode 1, 2, 3, and 4. And mode 1 is essentially a one-armed spiral mode. 2 is a two-armed spiral, and so on. And in the top right, you can see the relative amplitudes of these different modes. And for this galaxy, and actually for all of our sample, mode 2 was absolutely the dominant component, which is probably not unexpected because this is the two-armed spiral mode. But we can learn more than that from the Fourier modes. They can also tell us where the bar and where the spiral arms are. So in the bottom right panel, I show the phase angle of the mode 2. And you can see that there's this kind of flat region, which indicates the extent of the bar. And then when the spiral arms kick in, it goes upwards. There's a gradient upwards. And it turns out that not only can we learn where the bar and the spiral arms are, but from the gradient of this slope, we can also derive the pitch angle of the spiral arms. So all of this allows us to kind of consider both the spiral properties and the bar properties in these residual maps separately. And that's what I'm showing down here in the bottom. For the spiral properties, we've got the spiral light fraction, and we've separately got the bar light fraction. Those dwarfs that do have bars tended to have kind of similar-ish fractions of light in both the spirals and the bars. We've also got the pitch angles shown down here. There's a little bit of a range, but the range is kind of roughly the same as what you might find in more massive late type spiral galaxies. And then in the bottom right, I also show the bar length. And these are all plotted against the luminosity of the galaxy. Again, I'm not sure we can say we find any really clear trends with luminosity, but low number statistics is a bit of a problem here. So having shown that there seems to be this kind of cold disk component in the dwarfs, we can now try and ask the question of where does it come from? So one of the first hypotheses that we had was that it could be a recently quenched disk. We can imagine that maybe a spiral-like disk galaxy that was star-forming fell into the cluster and was recently quenched, and some of its spiral structure still remains. So to try and understand if this could be a possibility, we looked at our sample in a color magnitude plot, which is the panel on the left. And our sample is shown with these kind of large red symbols. And the normal red sequence of Virgo cluster dwarf ellipticals is shown in black with the gray shading. And you can see that our sample seems to pretty much sit nice and consistently within the red sequence of normal cluster dwarf ellipticals. And for comparison, I also include some blue cored dwarfs over here on the left from the Ulrich 2017 study. And these really clearly stand off the trend. So it does appear that, at least as far as we can detect, there isn't any strong evidence for recent star formation in our sample, and perhaps there hasn't been any significant star formation in the last one or two giga years either. When we look at their location in the cluster, we see that they're kind of distributed throughout the cluster. And if we look at their location in phase space, so this is a plot of cluster-centric velocity versus cluster-centric radius. Our sample kind of sit all around here at a low velocity and over a range of radius. And actually, this is the region where we expect objects that have already passed pericenter once to be found. And these gray pixels shows you the kind of probability density from cosmological simulations of where you find halos that have already passed pericenter once. So our sample doesn't seem consistent with objects that have recently fallen into the cluster. They have at least passed pericenter once, most likely, from the phase space diagram. So combining these two things, there's this possibility that actually some of these thin disks could actually be quite old, and potentially they may have been in the cluster for some time. This begs the question then, I mean, could there be more of these objects hiding away in the cluster that we just haven't observed yet? So we looked at our weak harassment models, our orbits, and we're using our high rotational model again. So this is our most sensitive model to tidal triggering. And we're showing them just after first pericenter passage in this image. And what you can see is that for all four of the weak harassment orbits, there really isn't very much structure being generated in their disks. They're still quite smooth, more or less, or certainly not the same amount of fine structure that we saw in the strong harassment orbits. So it seems that you really do require quite strong harassment to get this kind of tidal triggering of the features that we can observe. And so there's this possibility that maybe not all cold disks have actually been revealed in this way. There could be other cold disks that remain smooth and untidally triggered that's still hiding away. And they'd be quite difficult to detect because there's only a small fraction of the luminosity of the disk in this smooth component. So, does the idea that passive dwarfs in clusters having kind of hidden thin disks sound a bit far-fetched? Well, I remind what I said at the beginning, that Liske 2006 suggested that about half of the bright dwarf ellipticals in Virgo show disk features. And on top of that, the idea that dwarf galaxies have a thick and a thin disk is not entirely new. Joachim 2007 studied a whole set of late-type galaxies. He studied both giant galaxies as well as dwarf galaxies, and they were edge on. And so he could actually separate the amount of light in the thick disk and the thin disk components in these galaxies. And his sample is shown on the plot as black points. And you can see that massive galaxies like our own galaxy have quite a low ratio of thick to thin disk. So they're very thin disk dominated, which is what we expect. But then as we go to lower and lower mass galaxies, the thick to thin disk ratio goes up. And as we approach the dwarf regime where we are, they maybe start to approach about a ratio of about one, so equal thick to thin disk ratio. However, our cluster dwarf ellipticals seem to have much more extreme mass ratios than that. We estimate that they'd be more like a thick to thin disk ratio of about 10 or more, right up here on the plot. So this begs some interesting questions about the origins of these thin disks. If you imagine that maybe nature is responsible for converting these field dwarfs down here into these clustered dwarfs, then we seem to need quite a large morphological transformation to really convert so much of the thin disk into thick disk. And actually, in our simulations, we struggle to produce this strength of morphological transformation. The disks just don't thicken up that much. You can also imagine a nurture scenario, because in giant galaxies like our own, mergers are supposed to be quite important for dictating the amount of thick and thin disk. When you have many dry mergers, they bring many stars which are collisionless, and these build up the thick disk and the stellar halo of the galaxy. But when you have many mergers that are wet, they bring in gas, the gas ends up in the thin disk, and this builds up the thin disk with time. So you can imagine that maybe something similar happened for our cluster dwarfs, but for whatever reason, their mergers were much more dry than their field counterparts, which again could be related to environment. And the third idea is progenitor bias, which kind of combines both nature and nurture in some ways. The idea is that really we shouldn't be comparing the cluster dwarfs at fixed luminosity between the field sample and the cluster sample. It's quite likely that maybe both of these samples built up a thick disk in the past, but the cluster sample could no longer develop its thin disk with time, whereas the field sample could continuously grow its thin disk, and that could explain why the thin disk becomes much more dominant in the field sample. So in summary, the simulations basically show that tidal triggering can quite nicely generate the observed features. And this occurs whenever the models pass pericenter passage. And then this triggered structure fades away quite slowly. But to generate the structure that we see, we need a very highly rotationally supported disk component and quite deeply plunging orbits. And the observations suggest that maybe about 2 to 7% of the total disk light would be in this thin, cold disk component. And at least from what we can detect, it isn't clearly young. And so perhaps this implies that some passive dwarf galaxies in clusters could hide a thin disk component that has yet to be tidally triggered. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Rory. This is very, very nice talk. People is clapping. Is there any comment or question? Really, I have a long list, but I prefer to wait for the connection is unstable. So I can start with a question and comments, waiting for people. Which kind of simulation did you use?
So basically, this is my own simulation that I mentioned. This is the harassment model that I discussed at the beginning. So we're essentially modeling the cluster potential and all of the satellites within the cluster. Using analytical potentials, and they're essentially copied directly out of a cosmological simulation. So it mimics the tidal potential of a cluster in a cosmological simulation. And then I run my own embody tree code, basically build my own controlled model galaxies of the cluster dwarfs, and I put them into this analytical potential, and I study how they respond.
Is it an Hadron simulation?
These are embody only.
Particles. Embody only.
Yeah, these are embody only simulations. So they have a dark matter halo and a stellar disk. But that's because we're modeling passive dwarf ellipticals.
Yeah, which is enough. So, okay.
Carlo, can I ask a question?
Please, Ale.
Rory, you say it's written here in your summary that you need some typical condition to create this kind of feature, which is a close passage to the pericenter and a high velocity rotation of the galaxy. What do you expect is the number of galaxies which suffered statistically this kind of condition in a cluster such as Virgo? It's frequent or it's highly improbable or in the middle, I don't know.
Well, I think you can look at this two ways. I think the orbits that we require are quite plunging, as I mentioned, they're quite extreme. But they absolutely do exist in cosmological simulations. So I think those orbits can definitely occur. You also require this additional highly rotationally supported disk component, which is not what we observe, as I mentioned. However, when we observe them, we're kind of considering the total stellar disk dynamics. So if you actually have a small component of the light in a highly rotationally supported disk, and the majority is actually in a much more hot component, then when you look at the average, the total combined, you won't see such strong rotation. And I think that's why the idea of having just a small fraction in this highly rotationally supported disk could really explain the observations of the dynamics of cluster dwarfs.
And another question, did you study how the velocity rotation, the ratio of the velocity rotation over the velocity dispersion changes as a function of time for these kind of galaxies? Do you expect it to have an increase, a significant increase of the velocity dispersion?
So it does change with time. We can actually see at each pericenter passage, some of the rotational velocity decreases, some of the dispersion increases. But actually the response of even our highly rotationally supported disk is not as strong as has been seen in some previous studies. So I can actually show you a slide here of the disk thickening, for example. Here's our isolated model shown up here in the top left corner, and I've just plotted on the axis ratio. And here are our four strong harassment orbits, orbit S1, 2, 3, and 4. And you can see that, yes, of course, there is definitely some thickening of the disk, but it's not as dramatic. It's not as if these things have been converted into spheroids. They still end up quite strongly rotationally dominated and certainly flattened.
If you compare that to Ram pressure, what would you expect? You might expect also a thickening of the disk for Ram pressure, no? Because you remove some mass from the thin disk and you heat the system.
Yes, this is a really interesting idea. And it absolutely requires, though, that you have a very high gas fraction compared to the stellar mass of the disk. So I'm not sure that it's going to work for such massive dwarfs like this. I suspect that effect might be stronger at lower mass dwarfs, where the gas fraction becomes even higher. And then the removal of the gas could really actually do something to the stellar disk in those cases.
Thanks.
Do you foresee to any future imaging survey well suited for to probe your results with a larger sample?
So what's the next step? Was that your question?
Yeah, which instrument? Are you planning to use future instruments or future imaging survey?
Yeah, right. So there's definitely more than one way to move forward with this, both theoretically and also both observationally. So let's start kind of observationally. We're interested in trying to detect these thin disks that might be hiding away in the cluster dwarfs and not necessarily have been tidally triggered. And so we're trying to look for edge-on dwarfs. And when they're very edge-on, even a small fraction of the light in a thin disk could be more easily detected, because when you're looking down the disk, it enhances the surface brightness of that thin component. So that's one direction that we could go. We could also look dynamically. We could try and look for the two components in, say, for example, MUSE observations or spectroscopically. And actually, we're trying to do this both with long slit spectroscopy as well. And I think an interesting test is to look at the stellar population properties and dynamics of the thin and thick disk components separately and compare them. And this is something that we're looking into at the moment. And then from a simulation point of view, I think that we can certainly think about looking at this and studying this with hydrodynamical cosmological simulations. It's quite challenging because you need very high resolution to resolve the disks and their dynamics well. And most simulations can't really reach that, which are large scale hydrodynamical cosmological simulations. But I think maybe some of these Zoom simulations could potentially allow us to get there.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other question or comment? If not, thank you again, Rory. Before leaving, I would like to advertise next week Coffee Club. Next week Coffee Club will be done by a former PhD student from LAM, Ana Cabron, on LinkedIn. I suppose I don't have the title of the talk.